Welcome to the online ministry of La Jolla United Methodist Church, a congregation of faithful Christians along the beautiful Southern California coast. Together we seek to grow in individual spirituality and in community with one another. All are invited to join in this vibrant faith community. More information can be found on our website at lajollaunitedmethodist.org. May you be enriched in the hearing of these words, and may you receive and enjoy God's blessing.
Today we have two readings, very important readings. I'm sending love to you all through these words. From John, verse 1 through 14. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word was with God in the beginning. Everything came into being through this Word, and without the Word, nothing came into being. What came into being through the Word was life. And the life was the light for all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness does not extinguish the light. A man named John was sent from God. He came as a witness to testify concerning this light, so that through him everyone would believe in the light. He himself wasn't the light, but his mission was to testify concerning the light. The true light that shines on all people was coming into the world. The light was in the world, and the world came into being through this light, but the world didn't recognize the light. The light came to his own people, and his own people didn't welcome him. But those who did welcome him, those who believed in his name, he authorized to become God's children, born not from blood, not from human desire or passion, but born from God. The world became flesh and made his home among us. We have seen his glory, glory like that of a father's only son, full of grace and truth. From Genesis, verse 1 through 5. When God began to create the heavens and the earth was without shape or form. It was dark over the deep sea, and God's wind swept over the waters. God said, "Let there be light." And so light appeared. And God saw how good the light was. God was separated the light from the darkness, and God named the light day and the darkness night. There was evening, and then there was morning, and this was the first day. Praise be to God.
We are beginning, as I said earlier, we're beginning a new sermon series. And it's a sermon series that I must confess to you, it's a sermon series that I've done before. And the reason I want to confess that to you is, you know, I know that some folks from the PB Church, this was a couple years ago that I did at the PB Church, I know some folks from the PB Church sometimes tune in and join us, so some of this will be a little familiar. You know, Leah and I have made some adjustments. But it's not that I feel like it's important to do it again because I just want to recycle because I'm lazy, which might be a fair question since we just had a week off. However, that's not the case. It's something that I want to do again because I think it's so important. You know, there are lots of ways that the church is divided, and particularly in the United Methodist Church, we're really wrestling and we're facing. If we hadn't had this global pandemic, then we would have already had a general conference that likely would have decided whether or not the United Methodist Church stays as it is or if there's some kind of schism or separation. Like, we're at that point in the United Methodist Church. And I would suggest that the core reason isn't I want to phrase this well. very often we'll talk about the reason for potential schism is our differing views on human sexuality. And I would suggest that yes, that's an important thing for us to talk about, but really, really what we're actually talking about is how do we read our Bibles? What authority do we understand from sacred text? How do we read them? How do we understand this collection of writings? And so I would suggest that if we can have some authentic conversation about how we read our Bibles, then I think that can only help us. And frankly, if we understand that everything that we need to know about our faith can be found in our sacred text, in partnership with, you know, the Wesleyan quadrilateral, right? Scripture, tradition, reason, experience. But it's got to start with Scripture. And if we agree on that, if we can start with that, then it means we've got to spend time reading our Bibles and studying our Bibles. And we've got to use all four of those elements in the Wesleyan quadrilateral to come to deeper understandings of these intensely complex writings. And so that's the core purpose for what we're doing today. Now, I want you to know that primarily we are guided in this by a book by Marcus Borg called Reading the Bible Again for the First Time. If you have that book, if you've been reading along, we're not going to be able to cover all the intensely academic stuff that Borg is able to write. And so it would be a helpful guide for you if you want to read through that. If you're a reader, I know a lot of folks in this congregation are intellectuals, are academics. And so it'll be a helpful thing because there's a lot more in there than we're going to be able to cover during the next 7 weeks. 7 weeks. So what are we going to be doing for the next 7 weeks? So today we're going to be talking about Epiphany and creation. Next week we're going to talk about history and law. On January 17th, prophets and wisdom. So all of those are in what I would call the Hebrew Bible. A lot of folks call that the Old Testament. Our Jewish friends might get a little frustrated with us calling that old, right? Yes, it's old, but sometimes we devalue things because of their age. So the Hebrew Bible is one way to talk about that. Then January 24th, we'll get into letters and epistles. And then January 31st, Gospels and Acts. I want you to know that the reason that we're ordering them that way is for the most part, the letters and epistles were written before the Gospels. Okay, so that's why we're taking them in that order. And then January 31st, Gospels and Acts. It's February 7th, Revelation and Apocalypse. And February 14th, Practical Theology. That's also Scouting Sunday. You might observe that there's a connection between Practical Theology and Scouting Sunday. So that's what we're expecting to go through when it comes to this series. And that's going to take us from now all the way into Lent. Okay, so the Sunday after February 14th, so the 21st, that's when we're going to start Lent. Okay, now, I want to talk about how we read our Bibles, because for the most part, there are sort of two, we might say, competing camps in terms of how we read our Bibles. And I'm going to use a couple of phrases that I really don't intend to be, you know, pejorative or negative in any way. It's just, this is how I think about it. And so if you fall into one or the other of these and you feel like there's a better way for me to name this, please let me know. But those who are more fundamentalist or conservative evangelical would describe themselves, when it comes to reading the Bible, they would describe themselves as Bible-believing Christians. And they would say that they believe in the inerrant, infallible Word of God, that the Bible is that, right? The Bible is never wrong, infallible, the absolute, capital T, truth, Word of God. Now, those who would identify themselves more as moderate to liberal Christians would say, "Of course I give authority to the Bible. I believe in what is written in the Bible. Inerrant, infallible, I have some questions about that. I'm not sure about that." Now, you might find yourself in one of those two camps. You might find yourself somewhere in between. But as I observe sort of the world, the religious landscape, that's what I observe. Now, as we go through this series, I want you to know that I'm going to be authentic with you about where I am and what I think. But I also want to say that that doesn't mean that you have to think it. I don't think that I'm the authority of capital T truth. I think that's God. So I'm not going to tell you what to think or what to believe. I am going to tell you what I think and what I believe. And we can engage in conversation about those things. Whether that's in a one-on-one meeting, whether that's in the, you know, our post-worship Zoom, our virtual patio, any of those times are great times to have those conversations. So, with that in mind, I want to talk about those fundamentalist or conservative evangelical views of the Bible, particularly the idea of biblical inerrancy, because I want you to know that biblical inerrancy is relatively new. Now, this might be a sort of a rough thing to think about. New? What? How could this possibly be new? Biblical inerrancy is rooted in the Reformation, but I'm not talking about folks like Calvin and Luther. That's not who I'm talking about. Calvin and Luther had a high sense of scriptural authority, but they didn't necessarily take everything in the Bible literally. See, that didn't start until two or three generations later through something named plenary inspiration. The earliest source, and Borg references this in a footnote, like I had to go find this in a footnote of his book. Borg references this in a footnote, and in that footnote, it finds the earliest understanding, at least academically and in written sources, the earliest understanding of plenary inspiration in terms of this biblical inerrancy was writings from Johann Quensted, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, in its own footnote in the Anchor Bible Dictionary in 1992, right? But that's Johann Quensted not writing about this in 1992, but that's a footnote that goes back to 17th, 18th century. But again, two to three generations after Luther and Calvin. So does that make sense? So after Luther and Calvin, theological conversation began to grow. How we read our Bibles began to change, particularly because of the printing press and availability of translations. And that's when Johann, and probably some of his contemporaries, began talking about the Bible as literal writing. But friends, not before then. From then until now, things have continue to evolve, and there are some who continue to affirm biblical inerrancy, but that runs into trouble when we look at science and academia, when we wrestle with how languages are translated and how we kind of understand words. If you're someone who's bilingual, you know that sometimes there's a word that doesn't have a direct translation to another language, right? And so there are some of those things that come up in translation. Historical and cultural relativity today, when we're thinking about kings and armies, what does that mean for our cultural relativity today? The idea of modernity and even on the cusp of postmodernity, we move a little bit beyond capital T truth and understand the nuances of perspective. Religious pluralism is an important factor of all this. When we meet someone who is from a different faith tradition and we observe that this person is a good person, a holy person, and how could we say that maybe that person doesn't deserve or get God's grace and love? And so we have to face these kinds of difficult questions, and those kinds of difficult questions have caused us to move a bit away, at least some of us, from the idea of biblical inerrancy, which, again, is relatively new. So then the question comes for those of us who would identify as moderate to liberal Christians, how do we read the Bible? Is the Bible God's direct and divine word? Or, and here's one way that Borg describes it, is the Bible the product of two ancient communities, the Hebrew Bible from ancient Israel and the New Testament from early Christians? Here's some place that I really wrestle with what Borg writes, because Borg says you gotta pick. Borg says you have to decide that either the Bible is God's direct divine word or the Bible is the product of two ancient communities. And I like to think I'm a good Wesleyan, Wesley has a great way of doing both and, right? Wesley has a great way of putting things together. Just a quick aside, if you're not sure who I'm talking about when I talk about Wesley, I'm talking about John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist movement, right? He has a great sort of sense of putting things together, both and. And I find myself wanting to do that as well. Borg says you got to choose. I just want a name that I'm wrestling with that. I'm not sure I want to choose. Because what I would rather think about is that the Bible is the product of two ancient communities inspired by God. Breathed into. The word inspired has a connection to being breathed into. So the Bible being a product of two ancient communities breathed into by God. But Borg has one more way of thinking about the Bible. And he talks about the Bible as a sacrament, as an ancient dialogue. He talks about the Bible being a written response to the power of God in the lives of ancient people. He also describes it using a Buddhist concept. See, in Buddhism, teachers would say that the teachings of the Buddha point us elsewhere. And so if we take that concept and apply it here, we might look at the Bible as that which points us to God. And I want you to see this visual. Imagine, and this goes back to that Buddhist saying, imagine a finger pointing to the moon. Where do you look? Do you look at the finger or do you look at the moon? Which is more important? So if we apply that same thing to the Bible as that which points us to God, which is more important, God or that which points to God? I'm not saying the other is not important at all. It points us to God. But in what do we believe? Do we believe in words on paper, or do we believe in the living and breathing God? Indeed, Borg invites us to think that the lens through which we may experience the living, breathing, active, present God calls us to believe in God rather than believing in that lens. He writes it this way: to be Christian is to live within the Christian tradition as a sacrament and to let it do its transforming work within and among us. To live within the Christian tradition as a sacrament and to let it do its transforming work within and among us. I've been talking for 6 months now about how our faith has to change us. And that we have to live out that change. Otherwise, what are we doing? To be Christian is to live within the Christian tradition as a sacrament and to let it do its transforming work within and among us. So that's sort of how we're going to approach our sacred texts as we move through these next several weeks. And I hope that makes sense to you. I hope the idea of lenses is a helpful thing. If you're not clear on lenses, because I probably could have been a bit more clear, but think about it. I wear glasses, and I haven't worn glasses my whole life. I started wearing glasses back in the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, because I was working on computers 8 hours a day, and I started to get headaches. And they said, well, you should probably wear glasses. And so I started wearing glasses. I didn't wear them all the time, and then I got into my mid-40s, and my eyes started to change. I had my little skin cancer thing where now I'm missing half an eyebrow, and so I just wear them all the time, partly because I'm self-conscious, and partly because now if I don't wear them, I can't see. Like, it's not a huge prescription, but, you know, things are fuzzy. But if I give my glasses to somebody else, they're not going to see the same through these lenses. Right? Everybody has lenses through which they see the world. Pastor Leah was born in Florida. Well, actually, so was I, but different parts of Florida. She has a different experience of the world than I do. I moved to California when I was 5, and you didn't get to the good place until much later. Right? My mom was born in Florida. She experienced a different way of living in the world than I did. My kids look through their own lenses of the world different from my lenses. But somebody who was born and grew up in Brazil is going to look at the world through different lenses. Someone who was born in South Sudan is going to look at the world through different lenses. Somebody who was born in Eastern Russia is going to look at the world through different lenses. Someone who was born in Western Europe is going to look at the world through different lenses. Someone who was born in Jerusalem is going to look at the world through a different lens. Somebody who was born in Palestine, just a few miles away, is going to look at the world through a different lens. We all look at the world through different lenses. And that changes how we see things. Perhaps one way that we can apply that idea of lenses is to understand that the lens through which we may experience the living, breathing, active, present God is that we might believe in God rather than the lens. So with this in mind, I want to move into the creation stories. And I would suggest that the two scriptures we heard today are both creation stories, one from Genesis and one from the Gospel of John. But I want to focus on the creation story in Genesis. And so you may understand that, well, sure, we heard the first five verses of that creation story. But did we? Do you remember that there are two creation stories in Genesis? See, Genesis, the first 11 chapters of Genesis, really might be considered prehistory. Like, maybe the earliest actual history comes with Abram and Sarai. Abraham and Sarah, but before that, Abram and Sarai. And so what are the stories that happen in those first 11 chapters? God creates the world in 6 days, and then God takes a nap. Okay, Adam and Eve are created. They mess up right away. They start talking to a snake, and then they get kicked out of the garden. Their kids mess up right away. Really, Cain more so than Abel, of course. The prehistory includes advanced age like Methuselah, who was nine, like Yoda years old. There's giants, there's the global flood, there's the Tower of Babel. These are all happening in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and we might identify these as prehistory. But again, focusing on the two creation stories and how we might look at those might help us discern how to look at the other prehistory stories. And so I'm going to focus on those two. So the first two stories of creation in Genesis, they happen in Genesis 1 and early chapter 2, and then the rest of chapter 2 into chapter 3. Okay? And so those are divided into the priestly story and the Yahweh story. But those were written at different times by different authors. We have a tendency to put them together. But that's actually not appropriate because stuff happens in a different order. Look at them. Take time. Not right now, I'm still talking. But take time to read these two stories and look at the important differences. Because the important differences tell us about the authors and what they're trying to tell us in the way they write these stories. The priestly story was written in the 500 BCE. Right? The Yahweh story written even earlier, the 900s BCE. If you're not sure, that acronym BCE is before the Common Era. Some people just say BC, before Christ. Science uses BCE, before the Common Era. The priestly story was written around the time of the Babylonian exile. Now imagine you're in a community, and this is, I'm sure, hard to imagine. Imagine you're in a community whose hometown is sacked and you're taken away to a different city, a different place. You're in exile. Everything is different. It's easy for people in that circumstance to begin to lose their cultural identity. And so this story of creation is written at a time that people want to reclaim their cultural identity. And what's one way to do that? To talk about the Sabbath. A Sabbath that's so important that even God does it. A story that lines up with the observable universe, right? Imagine 500 BCE, you're in this, you know, place that's unfamiliar to you, but what is familiar? What's the same everywhere you go? The dome of the sky, the light and the dark, the stars and the moon. And so you find comfort in this poetic story that lines up with what you're able to see. But just as important, it proclaims Israel's God as the creator of all that is. I mean, imagine what happens when this army comes in and conquers your area and takes you out, and what are they going to tell you? Our God is stronger than your God. And so what is a natural response to that? You might think so, but our God created everything that you see, including the dome of the sky. The Yahweh story was written earlier. And so it has a different priority. In fact, the Yahweh story gives humans priority. Remember, although this was written earlier, it's the second story in Genesis. But notice that it creates Adam first. Now, I pronounce it Adam. The Hebrew article ha-Adam often goes before that. And the way my Hebrew Bible professor taught it to me, it's a gender-neutral term that simply means the human. Now, reading Borg's book, I learned that it actually puts two ancient words together for humankind and dust. And of course, when it comes to Ash Wednesday, we remember, from dust we were created, from dust we shall return. But it puts the creation of the human first before vegetation and animals, because then God brings everything to the human to name it. But it shows the need for companionship with other humans as the next human is created, but also with God. And it highlights human nature. It highlights temptation. Now, I would suggest that the early Christian view of these creation stories was not necessarily literal. And it wasn't until that 17th and 18th century, those second or third generation of theologians after Luther and Calvin, that people started to consider these factual stories, which then, of course, were later challenged by scientific discovery. But if we look at very early Christians did not look at these as literal readings. And I want to read to you a quote from Origen of Alexandria. Right? Origen of Alexandria, you know, from 184 to 253, a very early Christian, strongly critiqued the idea of a literal reading. And he writes it in this way. Origen is a contemporary of St. Augustine. Origen writes this: "What intelligent person can imagine that there was a first day, then a second day, and a third day, evening and morning, without the sun, the moon, and the stars? Sun, moon, and stars are created on the fourth day. And that the first day, if it makes sense to call it such, existed even without a sky, because the sky is created on the second day. Who is foolish enough to believe that, like a human gardener, God planted a garden in Eden, in the east, and placed in it a tree of life, visible and physical, so that by biting into its fruit, one would obtain life, and that by eating from another tree, one would come to know good and evil? And when it is said that God walked in the garden in the evening and that Adam hid himself behind a tree, I cannot imagine that anyone will doubt that these details point symbolically to spiritual meanings by using a historical narrative which did not literally happen." This might be a strong indicator, friends, about how early Christians viewed these prophetic and important stories in our faith. Now, if you're feeling challenged, if you're feeling like, well, what do I do with my Bible then? How do I believe and learn from what's written here? Maybe we need to understand another way. There's a contemporary theologian who has gotten into trouble by calling these stories the creation poems. Maybe you've heard of him. Rob Bell was an evangelical preacher until the evangelicals decided he wasn't evangelical enough. He does a great podcast now if you want to listen to his podcast. Because when we talk about something as poem, when we talk about something, another word that's been described as, for these creation stories is myth. When we use those words, sometimes we think of words like poetry and myth as derogatory, as negative, as pejorative. But perhaps we don't have to think of them. Frankfurt in 1946 wrote, "Myth is a form of poetry which transcends poetry, in that it proclaims a truth." An author by the name of Mircea Eliade, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that name wrong, one of the greatest scholars of religion in the 20th century, wrote Myth and Reality, wrote this: "Myth and reality go together, myth being the language for talking about what is ultimately real. For Eliade, myths are true, even if they are not literally true." So what then can it mean for our creation stories to have importance to us, to be relevant to us? God created the heavens and the earth. Maybe that's the only thing that we can take as literally true, and the rest has different importance. And perhaps it's an importance of our relationship. Because God's creation and creativity continue to invite us into relationship and connection and care, and it's grounded in the sacred. See, to say that God is creator, it affirms a relationship and a process that continues into the present. Borg writes it this way: God brings forth the universe from God's being. Because the universe comes out of God's being, it is in some sense God's stuff. This model does not identify the universe with God, for God is more than the universe. Rather, it sees the universe of being of God and in God. And what this means is that everything that has been created and everything that continues to be created is deeply and intimately connected to God. Perhaps this is how we can find value in these important sacred texts, in these important creation stories. It is my hope, my friends, that you have lots of questions. I think when we have lots of questions, when we engage in dialogue, that helps us to grow. There will be a time after this worship service with a Zoom. The link is on the webpage. Please join in that conversation and share your questions. If they're not questions you feel able to share in that setting, please contact me or Pastor Leah, and please begin these conversations. Remember that the lens through which we experience the living, breathing, active, present God is the Bible, and that we must believe in God more so than the lens. Remember that to be a Christian is to live within the Christian tradition as a sacrament and to let it do its transforming work within and among us. We will continue to explore these important and sacred texts, understanding that even if we look at these texts in a way that is beyond literal, I would even say more than literal, that does not devalue these sacred texts, but from my perspective, make them more holy and more God-breathed. It is my hope that we can continue on this journey together. Amen.